Hello, welcome back. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Laborers Talk Radio. Thank you very much for tuning in. We enjoy your company. We appreciate all the great stuff you're doing for the community. Hey, this program is sponsored in part by AppletreeMediaWorks.com and the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, and we appreciate their support. Joining me today by phone, we've got Bill Lonergan, president of the Kentucky AFL-CIO. Bill, welcome back. Hello, Bill. We lost Bill. We're going to get Bill back. I was kind of excited to talk to Bill because I haven't talked to Bill for a while.
Actually, I'm here, Charles.
Oh, there you go. Did you hit the mute button? Did you hit the mute button on your phone?
Didn't hit it. I actually put it on purpose, though.
There you go. So, hey, first off, it's been a while since we had a chance to talk to you. You guys have a couple of things going on. You've got a lawsuit going on. How's that going?
Oh, it's progressing along. You know, we've had to file a lot of different papers regarding our position. The defendants, the governor and the Secretary of Labor here in Kentucky have filed a motion to dismiss our lawsuit right off the bat. And, of course, we've objected to that and filed our, you know, briefs in response. And we're waiting for a decision by the judge. And we fully expect him to deny their, you know, motion to dismiss, you know, based on the fact that, you know, we need to have a hearing on this lawsuit, Charles, and not just let it go by the wayside, that we have significant constitutional issues that we've brought up and that need to be adjudicated. And we need to be able to call witnesses and do cross-examination and do everything else you do at a trial and try to get the facts out about how this law is illegal and discriminatory against labor unions and the workers. And so we're pursuing that along those lines at this point. And we can see that the National Right to Work so-called Legal Defense Foundation has also filed to intervene in our lawsuit, really, you know, showing exactly where right to work comes from, Charles, which isn't really from Kentucky. It's from, you know, the national office, national program to undermine unions and workers across the country.
Aren't they from Washington, D.C.?
Well, they're from Northern Virginia, actually, Charles, and Springfield, Virginia is where their headquarters is. But that's as good as being in Washington, obviously. And you know, this is, you know, kind of the mode of operation that they, you know, undertake and do all the time. Any place there's a opportunity for them to jump in and promote their anti-union cause, that that they do it. And here in Kentucky, they found three workers that they said they were representing that were actually the interveners. And Charles, we've challenged their standing. Two of them were actually working a shop where there is no union at this point. They don't even pay union dues, and we can't even see how they have standing whatsoever. Unfortunately, the judge sided with the Right to Work Committee and let them intervene, Charles, but we are filing a motion to reconsider that based on the facts and the way we figure that the judge totally misinterpreted what the purpose and the standing of these movements are. So we're pushing back on that to try and get him to reconsider that. And we're hoping to get a decision on the motion to dismiss here in a few weeks here, if not before. And then, Charles, we're hoping to go forward with a, you know, summary judgment and have ourselves a trial and get the folks that, you know, make all these great claims about right to work. And, you know, let's get them on the stand and see where they get their information and where their facts are and see if they can actually, you know, you know, not make stuff up like they've been doing for so long, you know. So
Bill,
we're looking forward to that.
Bill, haven't they been called on the carpet by courts before?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, in several places, most notably Montana, Iowa, and other places where they've engaged in political shenanigans. Yeah, they've been called on the carpet before, you know, and have been found by judges to have violated campaign finance laws and all sorts of stuff when they get involved with these political campaigns. So, yeah, they certainly are not without sin, I can tell you that. And when you, you know, look at the position that they take on all these, you know, right-to-work issues in all these states, you know, it's just a big, you know, ploy to you know, put forth that right-to-work rhetoric. And basically, Charles, you know, they're funded by big corporations that they refuse to disclose where their funding comes from. But we know it's some of the big ones that are just anti-union. And this is part of what their mode of operating is, Charles, is to, you know, give us a hard time everywhere and, you know, try to participate in these cases under the guise of representing workers and such. So we're hoping that the judge will reconsider that. They have the opportunity, even without intervening, to file an amicus brief and to have their position considered by the court. So anyway, right now we're waiting for the judge on the motion to dismiss. And like I say, we filed a motion to reconsider on the intervener status, which isn't really, you know, the biggest element of the case, but, you know, it's something that, you know, we don't take lightly.
No, absolutely not. What are your attorneys saying about this strong case? Are they hopeful? Or?
Well, of course we're hopeful, Charles. We think we've got quite a few constitutional issues where they have, you know, violated the law, where they are treating us differently than other likely situated organizations, that they are requiring us to provide benefits to people that are not members of the organization. The only organization or entity that we can discern in anywhere where a court of the law requires us to provide benefits, and we are precluded from collecting any fees to provide those benefits. And, Charles, you know, for the folks that don't know what these benefits are, it's something called collective bargaining. It's called negotiating contracts. It's processing grievances and going to arbitration so that workers aren't illegally fired or discriminated against in their work. So these things are, you know, things that take a lot of resources to execute. Charles, as you know, when we go to negotiate a contract with a company, you know, normally the company has a slew of lawyers there on the other side of the table, as well as the company representatives, and it's a lengthy and involved and you know, costly process. And you know, why unions are the ones that have to do anything for free when no one else has to, that's part of our case, as well as other elements of the Constitution that they have violated and that we're challenging them on.
Right. You know, and it's kind of interesting because the attorneys working for the company, they've got their own union. Most people don't call it a union, but the Bar Association is an organization that advocates for, negotiates for, and assists with legislation on behalf of attorneys. And, you know, the Bar Association expects you to pay dues.
Actually, they don't expect you to, Charles. They require you to.
Well, there you go.
You cannot practice law in the state of Kentucky without being a member of the Kentucky Bar Association. And that's just one example, Charles. And there's so many others. You know, organizations that rely upon dues money to support their operations. You know, how do you have an office? How do you have employees? How do you answer the phone? You know, how do you send mail? All these things that are such basic elements of any kind of business operation, unless you can, you know, have the resources, the financial resources to do those types of things. So, you know, for the court or the state, more likely to require us as unions to provide benefits to people that are not members of the organization is just ridiculous, Charles.
Absolutely.
And when it comes to what we provide, it's you know, so significant that, you know, most people that aren't in unions don't understand that, you know, when we negotiate a contract, it makes an employee a completely different animal than somebody that is not in a union, which is an at-will employee who is completely at the will of the employer as to whether they maintain their work status. As opposed to a union where we have a contract, a set of rules and regulations, a procedure and a process that provides for security for an employee so that they are not discriminated against, treated unfairly, or fired for no reason at all, so that they have some right to their job. And that's what collective bargaining is all about. That's why a collective bargaining agreement is so significant. So that on its face, it's just on the very value of having a collective bargaining agreement and not being an at-will employee is a tremendous benefit for people that are in a unionized shop. And those that benefit from that should be able to and required to, under a collective bargaining agreement, to pay a fair share fee to cover the costs of making a collective bargaining agreement happen, that to enforce the agreement, to process grievances and do so many other things that are inherent in a union environment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right is right and wrong is wrong. And, Bill, you know from past experience, a lot of the judges that you've talked to in Kentucky about that failed attempt for right to work for less understand that and respect it. And I think anybody with a modicum of self-worth understands it too. So there you go.
Yeah, Charles. And you know, obviously this is not just, you know, the whole issue here. It's nothing that is not just, it just scratches the surface on the other right. elements of this, you know, right to work issue that are, you know, discriminatory, unfair, and you know, are basically directed at unions in a discriminatory and punitive way to try and undermine right. our ability to represent workers.
Right. Absolutely. Listen, Bill, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, I want to ask you your opinion on what you think happened in Mississippi with Nissan, and we'll go from there, okay?
Great.
Fantastic. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Laborers Talk Radio.
The self-described geniuses of Wall Street are being stupid again. In 2007, their stupid schemes and frauds crashed our economy, destroying middle-class jobs, wealth, and opportunities. Far from being punished, however, the scofflaws were bailed out by their Washington enablers. So the moral lesson they learned was clear. Stupid pays. Go stupid! Sure enough, here they come again. Rather than investing America's capital in real businesses to generate grassroots jobs and shared prosperity, Wall Street is siphoning billions of investment dollars into speculative nonsense, such as bundles of high-risk subprime auto loans. It works like this. Car dealers, eager to goose up sales, hawk new vehicles to lower-income people, offering quick loan approval even to those with poor credit ratings. Banks, eager to hook more people on monthly car payments, okay these subprime car loans without verifying the buyer's ability to pay. Then, a Wall Street bank's investment house buys up thousands of these iffy individual loans, bundles them into multi-million dollar debt securities, and sells them to wealthy global speculators. Last year alone, banks sold $26 billion worth of these explosive bundles of car loans. This is a gaseous repeat of Wall Street's subprime mortgage bubble that burst a decade ago. The scam generates easy money at the start for speculators and banksters, but as more and more low-income buyers are unable to make their car payments, defaults build up and the whole financial bubble pops. This is Jim Hightower saying, wasting America's much-needed investment capital on a scheme that intentionally puts people in cars they can't afford with loans they can't repay is not only stupid, but immoral, and is killing our economy. Why are we letting elite Wall Street loan sharks do this to us?
The International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 66, works with builders and contractors to build a better community. Local 66's tradesmen and women have received the specialty training needed to meet the complex challenges of any project, making them the most capable workforce in the region. From schools, highways, and pipeline projects to casinos and arenas, the operating engineers build any job, large or small. For over 100 years, Local 66 has provided superior service that our community can count on. They are your one-stop resource for qualified and productive operating engineers and heavy equipment mechanics. To learn more about the benefits of organized labor and more information about the International Union of Operating Engineers Local 66, go to www.iuoe66.org. That's www.iuoe66.org.
Hey everyone, let's all stop what we're doing and take a moment. You see? Every moment can be kind of special. But they could be loud moments, goofy moments, dorky moments. It doesn't matter. Because every time dads like us take a moment like that to spend with our kids, well, it's pretty momentous. So let's take a moment to make a moment. Call 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
The average time a resume spends on an HR manager's desk is 7 seconds, and most of them are tossed aside. Now imagine if one of those resumes belonged to Yasmin, who was
living in a shelter, juggling 3 jobs. I had to be resilient. That's something that you can't teach.
We rely so much on a resume, yet it could never tell the full story of someone who
had to be independent and take initiative, and that's how I handle every project I get.
Discover new ways to develop great talent at gradsoflife.org, brought to you by Grads of Life and the Ad Council.
Hello, welcome back. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Laborers Talk Radio. Thank you for tuning in. We enjoy your company. We appreciate all the great stuff you're doing for the community. Hey, this program is sponsored in part by the Association of Flight Attendants, Communication Workers of America, and AFG Local 2028. We appreciate their support. Joining me today, we've got Bill Lonergan, president of the Kentucky AFL-CIO. Bill, welcome back.
Hey, Charles. Great to be here. Thanks.
Bill, it's always a pleasure. We appreciate it. Bill, while Kentucky is not a southern state, you're a little bit closer to Kentucky than we are here, or Mississippi than we are here in Pennsylvania. It seems to me that there is a perception difference that needs to be addressed, talked to, reassured people when it comes to unions in Mississippi. I mean, you know, Mississippi, let's face it, it's pretty rough down there. And you've got things that you got to deal with on a daily basis. High child mortality rates, very low economic standards, so on and so forth. But I'm really kind of surprised that the working folks at the Nissan plant did not go for a union at this point in time. And I'd like to get your take on that.
Well, I got to say that, Charles, you know, you touched on one of the issues there, that, you know, the culture, the long-term cultural antipathy, animosity towards, you know, labor unions in the southern states, particularly Mississippi or, you know, other states. You know, Charles, during the middle of this, you know, effort, one of the governor from Alabama came on and, you know, made some real anti-union remarks, you know, widely reported, you know, don't bother coming here. We don't want unions, this and that. Part of that, you know, whole anti-labor culture that, you know, developed over the decades, Charles, as you know, how many companies, you know, previously, before they started moving overseas in mass, they moved to the South from the Northeast, from the Rust Belt, in order to take advantage of unorganized, less educated workers that had the ability to be divided along racial lines a lot more effectively. And Charles, you know, that legacy, you know, persists. There's no doubt about that. And Charles, people are, you know, generally speaking, in any organizing campaign, when they're facing an onslaught of anti-union propaganda from the company and from the community down in Mississippi, from other businesses, it is a powerful deterrent, Charles, when folks are, you know, afraid that the job that they got, which is paying more than they typically would get in that economy, in that area, when they're threatened with their jobs and everything else that goes along with it, it's a powerful, you know, deterrent, so to speak, you know. People are, generally speaking, afraid of for their jobs. And when they are told that they're going to lose this, they're going to lose this lease car deal that they get through Nissan, when they're going to, you know, threaten to lose the factory and everything that goes along with it, that, Charles, has a big chilling effect. And the result of that is that workers are typically more likely to not vote for a union under those conditions. And, Charles, you know, it's evident because of the, you know, you can tell the UAW has filed complaints with the National Labor Relations Board over the conduct of the election, an extremely vehement anti-union campaign that was put on by the company with, you know, unlimited one-on-one meetings with the workers and their supervisors. Charles, you can't, you know, imagine the kind of pressure that folks feel when they're put in that situation. You know, on the one hand, they want to improve their conditions. They want to have a voice on the job. They want to be able to negotiate fair contracts with their employer. On the other hand, they're put under such a, you know, pressure cooker by their immediate supervisors and all the bosses, the local media, local businesses, and who knows what else. And they throw it all onto these workers, and a lot of them are turned off, and they're unable to vote for a union. But I will say this, Charles, this isn't really anything new or unheard of that the union movement hasn't been through before.
Right.
If you go back in labor history, you can see that the, you know, organizing of the big three, Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler, took decades, Charles, took many lives lost, took many beatings and demonstrations and, you know, all sorts of effort on the part of workers and unions to try to organize those workers. And so, you know, this is, may just be the first time that they try and continue to try to build up confidence and solidarity at the work site in the coming years and try again. The union movement's been here for over a century. In many cases, in our state federation, over 115 years old, and we've seen these struggles before, and we know that this stuff takes a lot of time. And, you know, a lot of times workers will vote against a union, and then the company would have promised X, Y, and Z, and when those promises come out to be unfulfilled, then a lot of times they'll change their mind. And a lot of times when those conditions deteriorate and maybe the safety gets worse and more people are injured because they're being forced to work harder and harder on assembly lines, you know, a lot of times people's notions about, you know, what kind of promises were made change over time, and they take a different view on the next go-round. So, you know, it's part of a long-term struggle. And, you know, you can see the kind of pressure and the kind of opposition that's out there. And, you know, Charles, it's based on, you know, folks, these, you know, people that are opposed to the unions, the companies like Nissan, literally billions and billions of dollars of corporate money that can be thrown against these campaigns. And, of course, you know, the people may think unions got all this money, but we don't have anywhere near the financial resources, not even anywhere close to any one of these large corporations. So,
right.
You know, the playing field, so to speak, is certainly never level.
Right, exactly. And oftentimes the money that individuals think that unions have, well, that's the pension fund. And, you know, guess what? That's already spoken
right.
for. You know, so.
Yes, it's the union members' money.
Yeah. So, in any case, hey, Bill, I mean, you've seen well, we've got to get going, but I want to thank you for being with us today. And how do we find out more about you and the Kentucky AFL?
All right. Our Facebook is KYAFLCIO, and our website is AFLCIOKY.
There you go. We appreciate that very much. In the meantime, I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Labor's Talk Radio.